Welcome to Taos Center for the Arts Radio Hour. I'm Crystal Starr. This show is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities. Today, we talk about dance with local artists Kathleen Martin and Zach Bigby. Kathleen comes from Illinois, where she has had a rich career dancing with renowned ballet companies before coming to Taos. Her repertoire includes diverse parts in well-known ballets from main character Odette and Swan Lake to Cinderella, Beauty and the Beast, and The Nutcracker. Since she came here, she's been teaching and recently became director of Taos Academy of Performing Arts. She's sharing insights about ballerina life with Chelsea Reedy.
Okay, let's start off by talking about when you first came to Taos, and I think it was through teaching at Jelana. Is that right?
Yes, actually. So I was introduced to Taos, New Mexico through Jelana. She's one of the original ballerinas of America. She is a living legend, actually, in the ballet world. And she introduced me to Taos. She has a ballet intensive that's held up in the Ski Valley every year. And an intensive is a high intense training for young dancers. And pretty much every professional school and every professional company has a summer intensive, a summer program where young dancers come together and they dance 6 days a week, all day, every day, train. And it's a wonderful way for them to really explore their technique. It's a wonderful way for them to get exposure and also travel and see new things. So I did that when I was 13, actually. Yeah,
You came to train and as part of at the school. And so going back, it's funny that you say that about Jelana. Me not being in the dance world, I had no idea who she was. But of course, I've seen her over the years at the theater because the final performance where families come in from out of town and look at the performance. I remember walking backstage after the performance, and there was Jelana kind of in the corner backstage, and all these girls crowded around her, handing her their point shoes for her to sign. And I thought, oh, this is interesting. And then, of course, I did find out about really who she was and what her career was like. And it was such a treat for me to kind of understand that. And then that image of all the girls surrounding her backstage. So you came here as a teenager to train for the summer. Do you remember that? What was that like?
I do. I remember it was one of the summers where there were a lot of forest fires. And I remember being in, I'm sure it was a snake dance little caravan bus that they have, but driving down the mountain, the Ski Valley Road, and seeing all the smoke and like just kind of being a little worried, you know, like, should I be alarmed? and yeah, I stayed at Twining all those stairs. And then I remember there was a big thunderstorm and the power went out. And I was like, where am I? But it was gorgeous. We took the nature walk down to the KK to dance every day. And it was very much impactful on me, not only as a dancer, but as a human. I grew up in Illinois, so not a lot of scenery, not a whole lot to look at, in my opinion. And so it was really interesting to have a totally different change of view, you know, to look outside and see the mountains every single day. It was cool.
So the landscape made an impression. Was that your first time participating in summer intensive, or have you been doing summer intensives, you know, going back to when you were younger, or how did that fit in terms of your experience of the training?
Yes, that was my first program. It was my first time away from home for 4 weeks. All those things, you know, kind of had to figure out how to cook and stuff like that.
Interesting. So that was really your first time in Taos. Let's back up just a little bit more and tell me about how you became a dancer, or if, I don't know how young you started, but just kind of how did it come into your life?
Yeah. So my mom put me in dance class. I have two sisters. So it was just kind of a family affair, you know, drop the kids off, have them dance. And I definitely knew at an early age that I really liked it. But I was like Bambi. Like my legs were up to my neck. I had zero coordination. I just couldn't quite physically grasp ballet. So I tried some other sports, tried different athletics, but ballet kept bringing me back. I remember I was in softball and I was just so utterly bored. And I was doing grand-mamas out in the outfield. A grand-mama is a high brush of your leg. You pretty much try to kick your leg as high as you can. And I remember practicing those, being like, okay, maybe it's time to go back to ballet.
Interesting. Okay, well, let's, so from there, you obviously kept with it, kept dance. You came to your first summer intensive here in Taos. Describe coming back and teaching at that same program.
So Jelana came to the ballet company I was working for at the time. I was living in Boise, Idaho. So I was dancing with Ballet Idaho, and she came in to set a ballet. And that's how we reconnected. And we became quite close. And she was almost like my mentor. And she kept trying to get me to come out to Taos to teach for her and train under her as well. And I was like, why would I go to New Mexico when, there's all these trainings and all these large cities with all these, things that are attached with them. Like, I just didn't quite understand it. I obviously forgot the magic I felt when I was younger. One summer she convinced me. And the second I got off the plane, I was like, geez, Katie, you are so stubborn.
Well, I'm curious about that because you describe such fond memories from the time where you were up there as a student. And so why did you feel resistant to coming back as a teacher?
Ballet is 8 days a week, and I was in the thick of my career, and I needed a little refresher, and she was able to do that for me.
So let's talk about that, the ballet 8 days a week. So you danced professionally for 10 years, and again, me not being in the dance world, explain that, what that really means when you are a dancer and that is your full-time job.
Yeah. So yes, full-time job, being a professional dancer, you dance normally 6 days a week, honestly, but Monday through Friday, 9 to 5 type of a situation. You start every day with a traditional class, similar to drills if you were in other sports. And then you rehearse all day where you learn what you're performing. And a lot of companies will learn repertoires in advance. So they'll, so let's just say it's the beginning of the season, which is normally in the fall. And so you'll learn your fall ballet, but then you'll also learn your winter one and then your spring. So you're kind of always a step ahead.
Got it. So the life of a ballerina, I mean, already the word ballerina and the life of the ballerina is kind of twinkly and bright and glamorous and wow. Can you talk about some of the realities maybe that aren't so enchanting?
Yeah. Yes. It's an interesting reputation ballerinas have because yes, it is enchanting. We do wear tutus. We have the makeup and the stage lights and the parties and things like that. But there's a lot of grit that goes into it. And it's a very physical and mental expression. We have to be incredibly strong and also be able to be incredibly limber. So being able to match your strength and flexibility is kind of a game that lots of dancers play with. So there's lots of cross training. A lot of cross training that goes on. When I first started my career, I would go to the gym in the morning, dance all day, and then normally finish off of the gym as well. Just to try to be as on top of my game as I can because our bodies are our tools. And it's important to really put your best foot forward, I guess, if you will.
When you say that kind of that balance between strength and flexibility or being limber, depending on how you're getting stronger, that could mean that then you're becoming less limber. Or is it just a matter of, yeah, go ahead and lift some weights. And then what you're doing in the studio, the actual dance practice keeps you limber? Or is there an actual method or science to it?
Yeah, for sure. I kind of feel like every individual dancer or a training group comes up with their own formula, how to go about it. Mm-hmm. For me, personally, with a balance of strength and flexibility. I have a very flexible lower lumbar spine, lumbar back. My lower back is very flexible. So I would always focus on my core muscles, things along those lines to try to counter that flexibility so I could hold my body in the proper positions, not only to protect myself, but also to protect my partner. And just to be able to deliver the ballet technique as it should be.
Can you talk about the mental challenges? You said your body is your tool, all the many, many hours that go into strength and flexibility. What's the mental component?
Ooh, tough question. In complete honesty, there are a lot of mind games that go into being a professional ballet dancer. It's incredibly competitive and it's incredibly time consuming. So your friends, your roommates, possibly the people you choose to date, they're all in this ballet bubble. But then again, your closest friends are also your fiercest competitors and your direct competition. And so a lot of lines are blurred just because, like, you know, your friend that you're like, for example, like one of my roommates for 3 years was also my direct competition. So we would come home every night and like obviously talk and hang out, but like we both knew we were going for the same spots. And so it can be a little confusing.
Got it. Yeah. And so when you say competition, meaning that the title roles or the spots, as you say, in the production, is that there's this constant competition going on for who is going to get chosen for these roles? Is that where the competition comes in?
Exactly, exactly. So if you are part of a professional company, you have the job security for essentially 1 year for whatever your contract says. So regardless of what roles you are awarded or not awarded, you will have a spot in the company. So in that sense, you're quote safe, but then as you try to excel and get standout roles, that's kind of where the nitty gritties come in and, you know, putting in the extra work and putting in the extra time. And then also the relationships with the dancers and their ballet masters, ballet mistresses, the directors, all of those things come into play. Growing up in the era of ballet that I grew up in, we were taught that we are disposable. And if you're not willing to do X, Y, or Z, there are 50 other dancers who are. So if it's not happening that day, then, you know, shoo, go on. We have someone else to replace you. So mentally, that definitely takes a toll, definitely.
That was Kathleen Martin, director of Taos Academy of Performing Arts. When we come back, more from Kathleen about what it's like to transition away from dancing in the professional realm to teaching. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the TCA Radio Hour. I'm Crystal Starr. Chelsea Reedy is continuing her conversation with dancer and teacher Kathleen Martin. Kathleen retired from professional dance company life in 2017. She tells us about the transition and the perks and challenges that such a life change entails.
I retired from company life in 2017. And then I had my last performance last Nutcracker last winter, so 2019. That was more of a freelance artist. I was retired, but I was kind of doing random, hey, I'm back kind of things, and then coming back into hiding, going back out again.
It's not so long ago. This is only a couple years. And then the Nutcracker in 2019 would have been just 1 year ago. Yeah. As you think back, not that you have years and years to reflect on it, I wonder if there's something you really appreciate about your time in that world, in that bubble, as you say?
Mm-hmm. Oh, those were like the good old days. You know, like it wasn't long ago at all, but it feels like a million years ago. And although I struggled, those were the absolute best days of my life. And I was very much aware that I was living my dream every single day.
Okay, so this comes up not only with dancers, but professional athletes. I mean, I'm looking at you and you're like, are you in your 20s or are you in your 30s?
I'm a proud 32 woman.
32 years old. You've retired from this career in dance. And what was it like for you, kind of, I don't know if this is the term, but transitioning, let's say, out of that world? And I know everybody has a different experience with that, but what was yours like?
Yeah, for me, it was quite difficult. I really identified as being a ballerina. Like it was absolutely part of, I guess, who I am. And it was really hard. And so for me, the struggle came into what's next. And then also kind of accepting a new lifestyle, you know. At first, when I retired, I was like, I want to do nothing. It was kind of just finding a new identity, finding a new walk of life and how to take the lessons I learned from my career and blossom through them and apply that to whatever I did next.
So, okay. So you eventually find your way back to Taos. And now you're heading the Academy of Performing Arts, and teaching is a huge part of what you do, and teaching young people and children. What's your feel about that? Kind of finding your way back in a sense to the studio on Salazar?
Yeah. Through teaching, I really found a new love and appreciation for ballet. And I found that it was a wonderful platform and outlet for me to be a different example than what I had experienced far too often from different ballet teachers and people in higher power in the ballet world. I tried to teach using positive words. I tried to teach through example. And what I've learned and realized is, as a performer, there is a lot of ego that goes into it. And as a teacher, it's the absolute opposite. Like as an educator, it's not about you as a teacher. It's about them. It's about your students and being able to separate the huge, glamorous performing career and what you're trying to educate. It's hard. And coming here, I really wanted to do that with this community and show there is a lot of beauty in ballet, and you can teach it in a healthy, progressive way.
Okay, so you're also a certified yoga teacher, is that right?
Yes.
And I'm curious about that. How or why did you get into yoga and go through getting the teacher training? And I wonder if there's anything that you learned through yoga practice that then informs ballet, or if those two things communicate at all for you.
Yeah. A beautiful question. So I started yoga, honestly, as a cross-training tool for ballet. Like I said, everything was ballet. So I was like, great, this is a non-impact way that I can move my body. I can test my flexibility and strength. And I wanted to learn about my breath. And so I was like, perfect, sign me up. And so actually through yoga, I realized how many problems I had because of ballet, as in mental, emotional things, not problems, but it became aware to me. When I first started yoga, I actually wouldn't wear my contacts. So I couldn't see myself in the mirror. So I could stop judging and stop overthinking and analyzing and just truly feel what was happening. By removing my eyesight and seeing, as dorky as it sounds, from the inside out, it transformed my dancing, because essentially that's what dancing is. You know, like when you sign up for dance classes when you're younger, you you don't sign up for ballet because you want to point your toes and have the highest extension and be in the top companies and wear the tutu. You sign up for dancing because you love to move and you have so much going on inside you that you need an outlet for it to come out of you. And so it really brought me back to why I started dancing in the first place. Yoga really did a lot for me. It was really wonderful.
That's really cool. So you brought up the mirror, and I want to talk about the mirror for a moment. Most studios or all studios have mirrors, and part of what you're doing is inspecting every little move. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So every studio has mirrors, absolutely. And the mirror is a tool. It's supposed to be a tool where you use it as a reference point. You use it to see if what you think you're doing is actually what you're doing. And it's very easy to kind of obsess over your mirror image because essentially in ballet, we are trying to be as perfect as we can. When I was awarded a role and I knew I was performing this principal role at this amount of time, one of the first things I did was pretty much lock myself in my bathroom and just move my arms in the mirror and get the character out, the why are you dancing this way? And then I would go to the studio and physically work on the steps, always reverting back to the small movements, the one-on-one that I would do with myself in my little bathroom mirror.
Interesting. This opens like a whole nother can of worms in my head about character, which we haven't even touched. So you've talked about ballet, a very strict form. There are very specific ways in which even I think your fingers have to move through space. How does one assume a character and yet the way in which your fingers need to move through space, you can't alter that?
Yeah. So I can just give some actual examples that might be easier for me to project. But so, for example, Princess Aurora, Sleeping Beauty. She is dainty and calm and things like that. And so when you move your fingers and your arms and your chest and your neck, you show those things because you're speaking through your body. And as her character progresses, she gets older, right? You know, she starts off as an infant. Obviously, we're not showing that in the ballet. And then she grows up and she gets married. So throughout the entire ballet, you're developing through your womanhood, essentially. The same ballet, Carabosse, Disney labeled her Maleficent, but the evil fairy from Sleeping Beauty is a total opposite. And playing her, like I studied a lot of actually Voldemort in the Harry Potter movies. I studied a lot of him and like how he would hold his wand and kind of move like that. And I took a lot of that movement quality into my character. And it's more than just the steps. When you get to that level of dancing, it's again, like the why, like you can do one step over and over again, but 10 different ways, depending on who you're playing. Ballet is a lot of acting as well.
At the top of the show, you talked about Jelana setting a ballet. She came to your company and she was setting a ballet. Are all choreographers in the dance world, in the ballet world, former dancers?
I would say 99.9% of them, yes.
Yeah. Is choreography also something that you are drawn to, interested in, or is it just kind of as part of your job in teaching right now? I mean, you have to choreograph things, or where does that fall for you?
I don't really think of myself as a choreographer. I feel I am more of a teacher and a director rather than the purely creative end of it. That being said, having given the opportunities to choreograph, I'm having a lot of fun and I'm realizing it's a really wonderful creative outlet and I have all these tools and lessons I've learned and it's a wonderful way to then project that onto new young dancers. But no, I'm having a fabulous time. We've had three productions so far this year, all online. And yeah, I've just run with the choreography and sometimes I'll do something. And I turn around and like everyone's eyes are like huge. And I'm like, oh, was that too much? Did I say it too fast? Like, but yes, choreography is a different way to tackle this art. It's a different way to piece things together. Instead of always doing this step and then this one following and then this one following after that, you can find a different way to go through the maze almost.
That was Kathleen Martin. The dance school she directs, Taos Academy of Performing Arts, is adapting to offer a safe dancing environment during COVID-19. For more information, check out their website at taosdance.com. Now we hear from Zach Bigby. He discovered dancing in high school and has been exploring the art ever since. He shares with us his rich comprehension of ballet and classical dance that he's developed through his experience of various forms of cultures, from Russia's ballet to Israel's Gaga and the Netherlands traditions. Here's his conversation with Chelsea Reedy.
It was the end of high school, so I'm getting ready to go to college, and I was like, I just need to go somewhere that's like green and verdant, because this like desert thing isn't doing it for me after all of these years. I was pretty certain that I was going to be a material engineer. I was like, that seems to be like the most geared towards what I'm interested in. And then my mother starts taking tango classes, and like they need partners. And so she brings me into the class. And after a while, this was like super fun, like social experience. It was really nice. And the teacher used to dance in California. And so she tells me, like, maybe you should try ballet, like it could be your thing. And I was like, yeah, I'll try ballet. Let's do it. And then it was like, I had always been like very physical, but also very into aesthetics. And so I was doing martial arts, which was really challenging, but not at all aesthetical. And so dance was kind of this perfect thing in that it was highly challenging and really physical and vigorous. It's also, you know, it's about how it feels and how it looks.
I want to start with just talking a little bit about ballet and how that really kind of sits in relation to other forms.
Yeah. And this is, the term ballet is from an Italian word that implies story told through dance. And then you have classical dance, classical dancing. And this covers kind of a broader scope because this is like classical music or classical art. And so it's just the practice as a whole. Ballet being what is put on stage when you tell a story through this classical art form.
I want to talk about music for a moment. And I've been around dance in terms of production and just being around the theater.
Yeah, yeah.
But it seems to me that there must be some unique relationship that dancers and choreographers have to music.
Yeah.
Would you say so? Or
yeah, of course. Yeah. And it, like, especially Megan, I think she's super connected to music as a dancer. And it has to do with the fact that, like, since a very young age, she's been practicing classical dance. And so classical music, because these things co-evolved, or it's like really built into the way that she understands choreography. And I also, like with music, it's such a way to set a mood. And dance is the same way. A simple gesture, pointing, for example, it can be really childlike when a child points at a dog, but it can also be really ominous, like when a ghost points directly at you. And so sound is giving a tone to dance, and the same way that dance is giving you a tone, like they're telling you how to interpret the other. They work together to inform what the audience's interpretation will be.
So I think you choreographed pieces, and I wonder when you begin in that process, are you starting with a piece of music, or are you starting with the idea of movement in your head, finding music? Which comes first, or?
It's like oftentimes it's a mood, and that's what I mean about how they inform each other. I'm like, I couldn't tell you exactly what I need this person to do, and I couldn't tell you exactly the sound in the background, but what ambiance I want to create. I know that I can create this if I'm using like surprise in a visual format, and if I'm using I don't know, something like dark and moody in the background. This gives a cast to the movement that's going on. So I think I kind of imagine the stage as like a three-dimensional canvas. The movement is recorded in this canvas with the sound. And so I think about this box and like, how am I going to fill it to make a composition, not just in space, but also like this composition has a set time. No one tells you like, and you will look at the Mona Lisa for exactly 45 minutes to understand its full meaning. And so, but with dance, it's like, 9 minutes. That's exactly what we decided. Nothing more, nothing less. And so it's the stage itself is a canvas that happens in three dimensions over two dimensions of time.
That was Zach Bigby. More from him when we come back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the TCA Radio Hour. I'm Crystal Starr. Zach Bigby is joining Chelsea Reedy in a conversation about dance. He was dancing in Chicago and Denver and decided to come back to Taos because of the COVID-19 pandemic. He shares his views on our contemporary relationship to dance. He also tells us about the immense expressivity of our bodies that have their own language and how dance is a vector of his expression.
So curious, I'm interested in terms of you and your progression in dance and your, you know, starting out when you said, and as you've gone through it, what's your relationship to, let's say, ballet and let's say modern? I've seen you do both.
The past five things that I've said about ballet have been, I hate ballet. And it's like, it is, it's archaic. It's archaic and it's like, in a lot of ways, it represents values that I don't agree with.
Can you give an example?
I mean, I feel that there's a really strong gender binary that is no longer relevant. It reflects an old division of the sexes, and that's like inherently an issue. In like this art form in its current state cannot be egalitarian. And it's like, it doesn't have to be egalitarian. If all of the women happen to choose to wear point shoes and want to pursue like an airiness in their artistry, and all of the men happen to want to do these big bravado jumps and stuff, then that's fine. But I strongly feel that like the option has to be there. And right now that's not the case. And it's because all of the repertoire, all of the ancient texts that have been passed down to us have this binary, and class has this binary. And it goes even further than that. Cause now what we're finding is like, you know, classical Chinese dance, this other form based in a completely different context and built on different bodies. And that's something that like the dance world doesn't really want to face today, is that ballet was built on the bodies of Europeans. And now in the US, we are not a European nation. You know what I mean? But the balletic fantasy should not be shouldn't be available only to white people, because they happen to be genetically connected to the culture. And yeah. So that's a limitation.
What are you, or what are dance companies out there kind of doing to acknowledge this idea? Again, what you said, it's based on this binary. It's based on European bodies, et cetera.
Exactly.
So what are you doing now? How do you go forward?
How? Yeah. Yeah. And so that's an issue. I think something, I mean, an easy thing, a simple thing that we can all do right now, and that is really common on the internet, is the glorification of those who have overcome. For example, like women who want to do male technique is now like, it's lifted up. It's like, she can do a double ensemble. That's really a powerful thing. And then people also happen to think it's really fun when men are like wearing point shoes and wearing tutus, and maybe that's an issue, that it's like inherently a comedic thing, but I don't know. I can't say that doesn't really, that's not really tearing down binaries, you know, but like celebrating a past of really great dancers or our present. Like Aisha Ashe is at New York City Ballet and she's like completely unbelievable. So sublime. And it's really great to highlight these people of color who have overcome. But we also need to acknowledge the fact that there is so much to overcome and there's a reason for that. So as far as what is being done, I think it comes simultaneously with this pandemic thing, which really disrupted how art is produced, in that, okay, how is art produced? Like, what is the role of the company now? If we don't dance in theaters, if we're talking about pushing dance forward within ballet, it's not, it's basically tasked upon the individual. So individuals such as Aisha Ashe, individuals who are not invited to the party, essentially, or in the past, like Maria Tallchief, the first prima ballerina from the U.S. She was from Montana, and she was Native American. And so they were tasked individually with climbing the mountain, and the mountain has not chosen to bow. Like, there are these huge hierarchies that are not choosing to disseminate. And so that's why we glorify these individuals, because they have really overcome something, something incredibly huge, and but the time is now to dissolve this huge obstacle.
Just a few moments ago, and you said it kind of in jest, and you said, "I hate ballet." And I have to say, I've seen you working with folks in the company and training people and stuff, and you seem so in your element, so comfortable, so clear about your direction and helping these young people get better.
It's a counterpoint we all need.
The reason I bring that up is that I guess I was surprised that you would, even in jest, kind of hate ballet. So when you're in the studio with these young folks and working with them, what's your feeling as you're doing that?
So yeah, there are so many problems with ballet, and I can go on, and I can break this down to a point where it's not interesting to anyone anymore. And the thing is, I try to keep good vibes only, when because there's so much good there. And I believe, so ballet and classical dancing, like I said, I kind of hate what goes on stage, because it's been stagnant for so long, and it's really ignoring a lot of issues within itself. But then the classical form, like classical dancing, I believe is very, the art form is approaching perfection really, really quickly. And it's really great for, it's great for me. Like, it's great for my mind and my body and my coordination, and it's a place to express. And I see this in other people, and I'm like, I know that there is like this truckload of garbage attached to classical ballet, but also there is the beauty, and we need to really dig into the pleasure of it. Like, we really need to dig into the pleasure of the practice. Otherwise, it's not worth it, because it's mostly shame. You know, it's mostly outdated standards of beauty. For me, the abstractness of the form is the only thing that's going to save it.
All right, let's talk about the Nutcracker. Let's put it into context a little bit, though. And so one of the things I learned just by being around the theater is that the Nutcracker, we do it every year. And a lot of dancers come up doing it from when they're little all the way through, you know.
And audience members, too.
And audience. You
kind of grow up with it.
Okay, so now I'm throwing the Nutcracker at you.
And so the Nutcracker, the Nutcracker is one of the reasons that I don't like ballet, but it's the reason that everybody else likes ballet. My opinion of the Nutcracker is all of the plot happens in the first act, and the second act is garbage, and it's just very dancey. It's a little bit too much dance, which sounds like a weird criticism of a ballet, but nothing really happens. And so, but people love it. It's enchanting. It's magical. There's lights. And so it's our beloved, iconic American ballet. It's really not so popularly performed in the rest of the world. And I think it is inherently related to our culture of optimism, our culture of maybe blind optimism and good intentions, because like going back to who built ballet, you have these scenes in the second act of Nutcracker. You've got Chinese, Spanish, and Arabian. And a lot of times they're really, you know, those Disney cartoons from the 40s that are really cringy. It can have that feel. And it's supposed to be beautiful. It's supposed to transport you. And so that's the thing, is it kind of needs to be brought forward. And in fact, it was made famous probably in the 40s. There was like a revolution in American ballet. But before that, in Russia, there was this ballet called Snegurochka, which means the Snow Maiden. And that was more popularly performed on Eastern Orthodox Christmas, which falls 2 weeks before our Christmas, I think. But anyway, and that is actually what Ballet Taos is going to perform in January. And so Snegurochka, the Snow Maiden, she's the daughter of Father Frost and the forest. And this ballet is a love story. She takes a fancy to a human man, but she does not have a human heart. And so she goes to her father and she says, "I want to fall in love. I want a human heart." And he says, "No, like, nothing good will come of this." And so she goes to her mother, the forest, and she says, I need a human heart. Like, I have to feel what love is. Her mother says, "Nothing good will come of this." And she says, "Please, Mom." And so her mother gives her a human heart, and she goes to this man, and she sees him, and they're filled with love for each other, and the love warms her heart and melts her body, and she dies. I feel that this has value in that it's talking about loss, which is... like, this is what the winter season is. It's a time of loss. Like, we're watching the leaves fall. Like, we're watching the fruit die on the branches. And there's a time to reap, a time to sow, a time to live, and a time to die. And so I think we can ignore the Nutcracker because we're going to do it forever. But for this year, we will ignore the Nutcracker. And in the future, I think it's about looking for a way to hold on to the magic of the Nutcracker, but complexify it. You know, it tells a very simple, straightforward narrative. And so it's time to find a little more complexity. And if we can't find anything new in there, if like we've totally mined the Nutcracker for all of its value, then like perhaps we retire the ballet and listen to the symphony every once in a while. Like, it's okay to throw something away. I believe preservation is important, but it's okay. There's hundreds of ballets. There's some of the most popular ballets in history didn't make it past 100 years.
You have an interest in languages.
Mm-hmm.
What's that from and how did that begin?
It's, well, I mean, who knows? So I was talking about the classical art forms a while ago, and I was taking a master class with this teacher from Juilliard. And she was talking about how this point behind your navel is where your true center is when you're turning. And she was also talking about how the fascia in your hand is connected to your back. And in fact, your middle finger in your hand is connected to your heart chakra. And so this is the Indian classical Vedic system of medicine, which is directly related to the Western classical system of dance. And so possibly the reason I'm interested in languages is because of some, like, you know, astral thing about how our chakras are stacked. Like, I think, who knows why anyone has a propensity for anything, but my, like, journey of languages started with a rejection of language. Because, like, growing up in New Mexico and being, like, a teenager who was too cool for everything, I found, like, everyone speaks Spanish. So I'm going to take Russian at UNM because that's way outlandish. You know what I mean? And so I took that with Larry Torres, which was quite fun. So I learned Russian and I went to Russia and I lived in Kiev. Yeah, and it was really a wild and necessary experience. And it gives me a much different outlook on a lot of things.
Interesting. This might be totally out there, but mm-hmm. I wonder if some of your language study interest, does that have anything to do with, does it cross over with dance, study of dance?
Oh,
dance.
And so it's, I've worked as a translator in dance classes for the Bolshoi Ballet, and I translated their teacher course to some people who went to New York to get certified to teach what's called the Vaganova syllabus, which is taught in Russia. So basically a certification course. And so that was an interesting moment of crossover. But also, I think, like, there's something to be said about dance as a language, particularly ballet, because it's highly codified, you know? And, like, it has very few words, in fact, but it has a lot of tones. So maybe it's more like something like Cantonese or like Vietnamese, because you can take a movement and you can augment it in size or in speed or in these various other ways. And actually, there are structures that kind of work like this in language. In fact, so there are six cases in Russian. Cases determine how the word functions in a sentence. And then there are six types of movement in classical dance. So I think the way that these connect is they are structures. They are natural structures. And I think that's why they're so incredibly complex, is because language developed organically into this, from very simple rules, it developed into a complex number of possibilities. And movement is similar. And if you think about the range of what can be done with a body, you know what I mean? Like, it's very, very similar.
Can you give an example, like an example that somebody on the street would understand in terms of a movement and connecting to the different tones?
Yeah, totally. So, I mean, if you imagine the difference between someone who knows they're going to miss their bus and they reach out, oh, wait, oh, bummer, and someone who thinks they might catch their bus and they hit the ground running and they're reaching, you know, to their fullest extent. So this is a matter of changing volume, which we have in language as well. And then there are things about tone, like there are things about softness and the same range of expression that we have with our voice, which is really complex. It's been evolved for a long time to be complex. I would say that we have a greater range with our body because we have a lot more possibilities of articulation. I mean, if you look at your body, it's the most complex machine ever built. And that's why most of our communication is nonverbal, because we have more facility to communicate in our body than we have only from the neck up. I think there's a direct language, there's a direct connection there, but also the carriage of meaning, because words, they individually carry an arbitrary meaning, but also gestures, the nodding of a head, the shaking of head, things that are not arbitrary, though. For example, you know, like falling to your knees and bursting into tears, there's only one way to understand that. The language of movement is interesting because it's immediately clear. You know what I mean? Like, words are very, a lot can hide behind them. And you can definitely hide a lot inside of you, but what you do is what you do. Like, that's just it. There's no, you can mince words, you can't mince actions.
That was Zach Bigby. The Taos Center for the Arts Radio Hour is brought to you in part by our local business partner, Metric Motors, and by the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor. And thank you to KNCE 93.5 FM, streaming live at truetaosradio.com. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you so much for tuning in, and have a great day.